that the sickness of society lay at the society level, not at the sickness of human beings in it. And if people did not challenge that, then they were, in fact, submitting to evil.
Modern psychology has a word that is probably used more than any other word in psychology. It is the word maladjusted. It is the ringing cry of modern child psychology, maladjusted. Now, of course, we all want to live the well-adjusted life in order to avoid neurotic and schizophrenic personalities. But as I move toward my conclusion, I would like to say to you today, in a very honest manner, that there are some things in our society and some things in our world for which I'm proud to be maladjusted. And I call upon all men of goodwill to be maladjusted to these things until the good society is realized. I must honestly say to you that I never intend to adjust myself to racial segregation and discrimination. I never intend to adjust myself to religious bigotry. I never intend to adjust myself to economic conditions that will take necessities from the many to give luxuries to the few and leave millions of God's children smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society.
The political influence of the Freudian psychoanalysts was over. Instead, they were now accused of having helped to create a repressive form of social control. Anna Freud and Dorothy Burlingham lived on in Sigmund Freud's old house in London. In 1970, Dorothy's son Bob died of alcoholism. And in 1973, his sister Mabby returned for yet more analysis with Anna Freud.
She went back for more analysis. She was living at 20 Marysville Gardens in the Freud house, as I guess she did when she wasn't with her husband, and she committed suicide. She took an overdose of sleeping pills.
In Freud's own house?
In Freud's own house, right. So, I mean, there are a lot of implications that one can draw from that, and I just think she happened to reach the end of the rope there. Although it would seem to be a very pointed act. Obviously, suicide is a very politicized act, and to do it in Sigmund Freud's own house is certainly different from doing it in Riverdale back in New York.
Next week's episode will tell the story of the rise to power of the enemies of the Freud family. They believed that the way to build a better society was to let the self free. But what they didn't realize was that this idea of liberation would provide business and politics with yet another way to control the self, by feeding its infinite desires.
To be lonesome. You know not what it means to be blue.
You've just been listening to The Engineering of Consent, part 2 of a 4-part video documentary, The Century of Self, produced in 2002 by Adam Curtis, adapted for radio. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW Warren.
Is there a flag upon your house, and a flag upon your car, and a ribbon on your mailbox with the stars and bars? Do you support the president and the war for oil? Do you think your sons belong there on someone else's soil? How far is it from here? Hear about Fallujah and 100,000 dead? Did you hear about the torture in the newspapers you read? Did you pretend it didn't matter? Did you blame a few bad men? Did you think your leaders wouldn't just do it all again? How far is it from
I began reading From the Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. Gatto spent 30 years as an award-winning public school teacher in New York City. In the prologue that I read last week, Gatto described how he decided to quit teaching after a long-growing realization that the whole system of compulsory schooling was damaging children, that it was based on control rather than enlightenment, that it was a sweeping program of social engineering designed to create dullness and conformity rather than stimulate the creativity and intellect of the young. This week, we begin Chapter 1, titled The Way It Used to Be, in which he begins to prove his case against the system of schooling. The chapter begins with these quotes, first from George Orwell. Whoever controls the image and information of the past determines what and how future generations will think. Whoever controls the information and images of the present determines how those same people will view the past. And this by Count Leo Tolstoy from his essay Education and Children. Take at hazard 100 children of several educated generations and 100 uneducated children of the people and compare them in anything you please, in strength, in agility, in mind, in the ability to acquire knowledge, even in morality. And in all respects, you are startled by the vast superiority on the side of the children of the uneducated. A nation from the bottom up. Establishing shot. 50 children of different ages are teaching each other while the schoolmaster hears lessons at his desk from older students. An air of quiet activity fills the room. A wood stove crackles in the corner. What drove the 19th century school world, celebrated in Edward Eggleston's classic, The Hoosier Schoolmaster, was a society rich with concepts like duty, hard work, responsibility, and self-reliance. A society overwhelmingly local in orientation, although never so provincial it couldn't be fascinated by the foreign and exotic. But when Tent Chautauqua, with its fanfare about modern marvels, left town, conversation readily returned to the text of local society. Eggleston's America was a special place in modern history, one where the society was more central than the national political state. Words can't adequately convey the stupendous radicalism hidden in our quiet villages, a belief that ordinary people have a right to govern themselves, a confidence that they can. Most revolutionary of all was the conviction that personal rights can only be honored when the political state is kept weak. In the classical dichotomy between liberty and subordination written into our imagination by Locke and Hobbes in the 17th century, America struggled down the libertarian road of Locke for a while her three godfather nations, England, Germany, and France, followed Hobbes and established Leviathan states through the 18th and 19th centuries. Toward the end, America began to follow the old world's lead. For Hobbes, social order depended upon state control of the inner life, a degree of mental colonization unknown to the tyrants of history, whose principal concern had been controlling the bodies of their subjects. But the sheer size of an America without national roads or electronic networks ensured that liberty would be nurtured outside the ring of government surveillance. Then, too, many Americans came out of the dissenting religious sects of England, independent congregations which rejected church-state partnerships. The bulk of our population was socially suspect anyway. Even our gentry was second and third string by English standards, gentlemen without inheritance. The rest a raggle-taggle band of wastrels, criminals, Shanghaied boys, poor yeomanry, displaced peasants. Benet the poet describes our founding stock. The disavouched, hard-bitten pack shipped overseas to steal a continent, with neither shirts nor honor to their back. In Last Essays, George Bernanos observes that America, unlike other nations, was built from the bottom up. Francis Parkman made the same observation a century earlier. What America violently rejected in its early republic was the Anglican homily on obedience set down by English established church doctrine in the Tudor state of 1562. A doctrine likening order in heaven with the English social order on earth. fixed and immutable. Quote, "The sun, moon, stars, rainbows, thunder, lightning, clouds, and all the birds of the air do keep their order. The earth, trees, seeds, plants, herbs, corn, grass, and all manner of beasts keep themselves in order. Every degree of people in their vocations, callings, and office has appointed to them their duty and order." Close quote. By 1776, the theocratic utopia toward which such a principle moves was well established in the Britain of the German Georges, as well as in the three northern German states of Prussia, Saxony, and Hanover. Together with England, all three were to play an important role in 20th century forced schooling in America. The same divine clock, superficially secularized, was marking time in the interlude of Enlightenment France, the pre-revolutionary utopia which would also have a potent effect on American school thought. Hobbes and his doctrine of mental colonization eclipsed Locke everywhere else, but not in America. You had to do it yourself. Cut to Abe Lincoln by the fireplace in a log house. "An American," Francis Grund remarked in 1837, "is almost from his cradle brought up to reflect on his condition, and from the time he is able to act, employed with the means of improving it." Lincoln, hardly a slouch as writer, speaker, or thinker, packed 50 weeks of formal schooling into his entire life over the 12-year period between 1814 and 1826. Even that little seemed a waste of time to his relatives. Unless you wanted to argue that those few weeks made a decisive difference to Abe, we need to look elsewhere for his education. Clifton Johnson thinks it happened this way. He acquired much of his early education at home. In the evening, he would pile sticks of dry wood into the brick fireplace. These would blaze up brightly and shed a strong light over the room. The boy would lie down flat on the floor before the hearth with his book in front of him. He used to write his arithmetic sums on a large wooden shovel with a piece of charcoal. After covering it all over with examples, he would take his jackknife and whittle and scrape the surface clean, ready for more ciphering. Paper was expensive, and he could not afford a slate. Sometimes, when the shovel was not at hand, he did his figuring on the logs of the house walls and on the doorposts, and other woodwork that afforded a surface he could mark with his charcoal. In Lincoln's Illinois and Kentucky, only reading, writing, and ciphering to the rule of three were required of teachers. But in New England, the business often attracted ambitious young men like Noah Webster, confident and energetic, merely pausing on their way to greater things. Adam Gorowski, mid-19th century traveler in our land, took special notice of the superiority of American teachers. Their European brethren were, he said, withered drifters or narrowed martinets. Young people in America were expected to make something of themselves, not to prepare themselves to fit into a pre-established hierarchy. Every foreign commentator notes the early training in independence, the remarkable precocity of American youth, their assumption of adult responsibility. In his memoir, Tom Nichols, a New Hampshire schoolboy in the 1820s, recalls the electrifying air of expectation in early American schools. "Our teachers constantly stimulated us by glittering prizes of wealth, honors, offices, and distinctions, which were certainly within our reach. There were 100 avenues to wealth and fame opening fair before us if we only chose to learn our lessons." Overproduction, overcapacity would have been an alien concept to that America, something redolent of British mercantilism. Our virgin soil and forests undermined the stern doctrine of Calvinism by paying dividends to anyone willing to work. As Calvinism waned, contrarian attitudes emerged which represented a new American religion. First, the conviction that opportunity was available to all. Second, that failure was the result of deficient character, not predestination or bad placement on a biological bell curve. Character flaws could be remedied, but only from the inside. You had to do it yourself through courage, determination, honesty, and hard work. Don't discount this as hot air. It marks a critical difference between Americans and everyone else. Teachers had a place in this process of self-creation, but it was an ambiguous one. Anyone could teach, it was thought, just as anyone could self-teach. Secular schools, always a peripheral institution, were viewed with ambivalence, although teachers were granted some value, if only gratitude, for giving mother a break. In the southern and middle colonies, teachers were often convicts serving out their sentences, their place in the social order caught in this advertisement of Washington's day. Ran away, a servant who followed the occupation of schoolmaster, much given to drinking and gambling. Washington's own schoolmaster, Hobby, was just such a bondsman. Traditional lore has it that he laid the foundation for national greatness by whipping the devil out of Washington. Whipping and humiliation seem to have always been an eternal staple of schooling. Evidence survives from ancient Rome, Montaigne's France, Washington's Virginia, or my own high school in western Pennsylvania in the 1950s, where the teacher's personalized paddle hung prominently at the entrance to many a classroom, not for decoration, but for use. The football coach, and if I recall correctly, the algebra teacher, customized their paddles, using a dry cell battery to fashion devices similar to electrified cattle prods. Something in the structure of schooling calls forth violence. While latter-day schools don't allow energetic physical discipline, certainly they are state-of-the-art laboratories in humiliation, as your own experience should remind you. In my first years of teaching, I was told over and over that humiliation was my best friend, more effective than whipping. I witnessed this theory in practice through my time as a teacher. If you were to ask me whether physical or psychological violence does more damage, I would reply that slurs, aspersion, formal ranking, insult, and inference are far and away more deadly, nor does law protect the tongue-lashed. Early schools in America were quick with cuff or cane, but local standards demanded fairness. Despotic teachers were often quarry themselves, as Washington Irving's Legend of Sleepy Hollow warns us. Listen to the fate of schoolmaster Thomas Beveridge at the hands of the upper-class Latin school in Philadelphia, 11 years before the Revolution. He arrives, enters the school, and is permitted to proceed until he is supposed to have nearly reached his chair at the upper end of the room, when instantly the door and every window shutter is closed, now shrouded in utter darkness. The most hideous yells that can be conceived are sent forth from 70 of throats. And Ovid's and Virgil's and Horace's, together with the more heavy metal of dictionaries, are hurled without remorse at the astonished preceptor, who, groping and crawling under cover of the forms, makes the best of his way to the door. When attained, a light is restored, and a death-like silence ensues. Every boy is at his lesson. No one had a hand or voice in the recent atrocity. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. In the humbler setting of rural Indiana, recreated by Eggleston for Hoosier Schoolmaster, published in 1871, we can easily see that passage of more than a century and the replacement of rich kids by farmers' sons and daughters hasn't altered classroom dynamics. When Ralph looked round the faces of the scholars, the little faces full of mischief and curiosity, the big faces full of an expression which was not further removed than second cousin from contempt. When young Hartsook looked at these faces, his heart palpitated with stage fright. There is no audience so hard to face as one of school children, as many a man has found to his cost. While Ralph was applying to a trustee of the school committee for his job, a large, ugly bulldog sniffed at his heels, causing a young girl to nearly giggle her head off at the delightful prospect of seeing a new schoolteacher eaten up by the ferocious brute. Weary, discouraged, shivering with fear, he is lectured. "You see, we ain't none of your soft sort in these diggins. It takes a man to boss this deestrict. If you get licked, don't come to us, Flat Crick don't pay no insurance, you bet. It takes grit to apply for this school. The last master had a black eye for a month. No limit to pain for those who allow it. One of the most telling accounts of schooling ever penned comes directly from the lips of a legendary power broker, Colonel Edward Mandel House, one of those grand shadowy figures in American history. House had a great deal to do with America's entry into World War I as a deliberate project to seize German markets in chemicals, armor plate, and shipping, an aspect of our bellicosity rarely mentioned in scholastic histories. When peace came, House's behind-the-scenes maneuvering in the League of Nations contributed to repudiation of the organization. His management of President Wilson led to persistent stories that Wilson was little more than a puppet of the colonel. In his memoirs, The Intimate Papers of Colonel House, we get a glimpse of elite American schooling in the 1870s. House's early years were school-free. He grew up after the Civil War near Houston, Texas. My brother James, 6 years older than I, was the leader. We all had guns and pistols. There were no childish games, excepting those connected with war. House was 9 at the time. In the evening, around the fireside, there were told tales of daring deeds that we strove to emulate. I cannot remember the time when I began to ride and to shoot. I had many narrow escapes. Twice I came near killing one of my playmates in the reckless use of firearms. They were our toys, and death our playmate. At the age of 14, House was sent to school in Virginia. The cruelty of the other boys made an indelible impression on his character, as you can sift from this account. I made up my mind, at the second attempt to haze me, that I would not permit it. I not only had a pistol, but a large knife, and with these I held the larger, rougher boys at bay. There was no limit to the lengths they would go in hazing those who would allow it. One form I recall was that of going through the pretense of hanging. They would tie a boy's hands behind him and string him up by the neck over a limb until he grew purple in the face. None of it, however, fell to me. What was done to those who permitted it is almost beyond belief. At the Hopkins Grammar School in New Haven at the age of 17, during the Hayes-Tilden campaign of 1876, House began to hang around political offices instead of attending to studies. He came to be recognized and was given small privileges. When the election had to be ultimately settled by an electoral commission, he was allowed to slip in and out of hearings at will. House again. All this was educational in its way, though not the education I was placed in Hopkins Grammar School to get. And it is no wonder that I lagged at the end of my class. I had no interest in desk tasks, but I read much and was learning in a larger and more interesting school. House's story was written over and over in the short, glorious history of American education before schooling took over. Young Americans were allowed close to the mechanism of things. This rough-and-tumble practice kept social class elastic and American achievement in every practical field superb. Now come back to the present while I demonstrate that the identical trust placed in ordinary people 200 years ago still survives where it suits managers of our economy to allow it. Consider the art of driving, which I learned at the age of 11. Without everybody behind the wheel, our sort of economy would be impossible. So everybody is there, IQ notwithstanding. With less than 30 hours of combined training and experience, 100 million people are allowed access to vehicular weapons more lethal than pistols or rifles, turned loose without a teacher, so to speak. Why does our government make such presumptions of competence, placing nearly unqualified trust in drivers, while it maintains such a tight grip on near-monopoly state schooling? An analogy will illustrate just how radical this trust really is. What if I proposed we hand 3 sticks of dynamite and a detonator to anyone who asked for them? All an applicant would need is money to pay for the explosives. You'd have to be an idiot to agree with my plan, at least based on the assumptions you picked up in school about human nature and human competence. And yet gasoline, a spectacularly mischievous explosive, dangerously unstable, and with the intriguing characteristic as an assault weapon that it can flow under locked doors and saturate bulletproof clothing, is available to anyone with a container. 5 gallons of gasoline have the destructive power of a stick of dynamite. The average tank holds 15 gallons, yet no background check is necessary for dispenser or dispensee. As long as gasoline is freely available, gun control is beside the point. Push on. Why do we allow access to a portable substance capable of incinerating houses, torching crowded theaters, or even turning skyscrapers into infernos? We haven't even considered the battering ram aspect of cars. Why are novice operators allowed to command a ton of metal capable of hurtling through school crossings at up to 2 miles a minute? Why do we give the power of life and death this way to everyone? It should strike you at once that our unstated official assumptions about human nature are dead wrong. Nearly all people are competent and responsible. Universal motoring proves that. The efficiency of motor vehicles as terrorist instruments would have written a tragic record long ago if people were inclined to terrorism. But almost all auto mishaps are accidents. While there are seemingly a lot of those, the actual fraction of mishaps, when held up against the stupendous number of possibilities for mishap, is quite small. I know it's difficult to accept this because the specter of global terrorism is a favorite cover story of governments. But the truth is substantially different from the tale the public is sold. According to the U.S. State Department, 1995 was a near-record year for terrorist murders. It saw 300 worldwide, 200 at the hands of the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka, compared to the 400,000 smoking-related deaths in the United States alone. When we consider our assumptions about human nature that keep children in a condition of confinement and limited options, we need to reflect on driving and things like almost non-existent global terrorism. Notice how quickly people learn to drive well. Early failure is efficiently corrected, usually self-corrected, because the terrific motivation of staying alive and in one piece steers driving improvement. If the grand theories of Comenius and Herbart about learning by incremental revelation, or those lifelong nanny rules of Owen, McClure, Pestalozzi, and Beatrice Webb, or those calls for precision in human ranking of Thorndike and Hall, or those nuanced interventions of Yale, Stanford, and Columbia's Teachers College were actually as essential as their proponents claimed, this libertarian miracle of motoring would be unfathomable. Now consider the intellectual component of driving. It isn't all just hand-eye-foot coordination. First-time drivers make dozens, no hundreds, of continuous hypotheses, plans, computations, and fine-tuned judgments every day they drive. They do this skillfully, without being graded, because if they don't, organic provision exists in the motoring universe to punish them. There isn't any sort of court of appeal from your own stupidity on the road. I could go on. Think of licensing, maintenance, storage, adapting machine and driver to seasons and daily conditions. Carefully analyzed, driving is an impressive a miracle as walking, talking, or reading, but this only shows the inherent weakness of analysis, since we know almost everyone learns to drive well in a few hours. The way we used to be as Americans, learning everything, breaking down social class barriers, is the way we might be again without forced schooling. Driving proves that to me. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. Two Approaches to Discipline. Rules of the Stokes County School, November 10, 1848. William A. Chaffin, Master. Offense: boys and girls playing together, 4 lashes. Quarreling, 4 lashes. Fighting, 5 lashes. Gambling or betting at school, 4 lashes. Playing cards at school, 10 lashes. Telling lies, 7 lashes. Telling tales out of school, 8 lashes. Nicknaming each other, 4 lashes. Giving each other ill names, 3 lashes. swearing at school, 8 lashes. Blackguarding each other, 6 lashes. For misbehaving to girls, 10 lashes. For leaving school without leave of the teacher, 4 lashes. Going home with each other without leave of teacher, 4 lashes. For drinking spirituous liquors at school, 8 lashes. Making swings and swinging on them, 7 lashes. For misbehaving when a stranger is in the house, 6 lashes. For wearing long fingernails, 2 lashes. For not making a bow when a stranger comes in, 3 lashes. Coming to school with dirty face and hands, 2 lashes. For calling each other liars, 4 lashes. For playing bandy, 10 lashes, etc. Whatever you might think of this, in light of Dr. Spock or Piaget or the Yale Child Study folks, it must be apparent that civility was honored, and in all likelihood, no one ever played bandy a second time. I've yet to meet a parent in public school who ever stopped to calculate the heavy, sometimes lifelong price their children pay for the privilege of being rude and ill-mannered at school. I haven't met a public school parent yet who was properly suspicious of the state's endless forgiveness of bad behavior, for which the future will be merciless. About the same time Master Chaffin was beating the same kind of sense into young Tar Heels that convict Hobby had beaten into Little Washington, Robert Owen, a Scottish industrialist usually given credit for launching utopian socialism, was constructing his 2-volume Life. This autobiography contains 10 rules of schooling, the first 2 of which show a liberalization occurring in 19th century educational thought. First rule, no scolding or punishment of the children. Second rule, unceasing kindness in tone, look, word, and action to all children without exception by every teacher employed so as to create a real affection and full confidence between teachers and the taught. The Owenite colony had what we now call a theory of holistic schooling as its foundation. Owen was a genuine messiah figure, and his colony operated in a part of Indiana which was removed from prying eyes. New Harmony, as it was called, was the center of the transatlantic upper-class world's fascinated attention in its short existence. Yet it fell apart in 3 years, slightly less time than it took for John Dewey's own lab school to be wrecked by Owenite principles, unmistakably enough to suggest Dewey would be better if he got out of Chicago. And so he did, transferring to Teachers College in Manhattan, where in time his Lincoln School carried on the psychological traditions of New Harmony before it too ultimately failed. Wherever it occurred, schooling through the 18th and 19th centuries, up until the last third of the 19th, heavily invested its hours with language, philosophy, art, and the life of classical civilizations of Greece and Rome. In the grammar schools of the day, little pure grammar as we understand it existed. They were places of classical learning. Early America rested easily on a foundation of classical understanding, one subversive to the normal standards of British class society. The lessons of antiquity were so vital to the construction of every American's institution, it's hardly possible to grasp how deep the gulf between then and now is without knowing a little about those lessons. Prepare yourself for a surprise. For a long time, for instance, classical Athens distributed its most responsible public positions by lottery. Army generalships, water supply, everything. The implications are awesome. Trust in everyone's competence was assumed. It was their version of universal driving. Professionals existed but did not make key decisions. They were only technicians, never well regarded because prevailing opinion held that technicians had enslaved their own minds. Anyone worthy of citizenship was expected to be able to think clearly and to welcome great responsibility. As you reflect on this, remember our own unvoiced assumption that anyone can guide a ton of metal traveling at high speed with 3 sticks of dynamite sloshing around in its tanks. When we are asked what kind of schooling was behind this brilliant society which has enchanted the centuries ever since, any honest reply can be carried in one word. None. After writing a book searching for the hidden genius of Greece in its schools, Kenneth Freeman concluded his unique study, The Schools of Hellas, in 1907 with a summary. There were no schools in Hellas. No place boys and girls spent their youth attending continuous instruction under command of strangers. Indeed, nobody did homework in the modern sense. None could be located on standardized tests. The tests that mattered came in living, striving to meet ideals that local tradition imposed. The word skola itself means leisure. Leisure in a formal garden to think and reflect. Plato in the Laws is the first to refer to school as a learned discussion. The most famous school in Athens was Plato's Academy, but its physical manifestation had no classes or bells. It was a well-mannered hangout for thinkers and seekers, a generator of good conversation and good friendship, things Plato thought lay at the core of education. Today we might call such a phenomenon a salon. Aristotle's Lyceum was pretty much the same, although Aristotle delivered two lectures a day. A tough one in the morning for intense thinkers, a kinder, gentler version of the same in the afternoon for less ambitious minds. Attendance was optional. And the famous gymnasium, so memorable as a forge for German leadership later on, was in reality only an open training ground where men 16 to 50 were free to participate in high-quality, state-subsidized instruction in boxing, wrestling, and javelin. The idea of schooling free men in anything would have revolted Athenians. Forced training was for slaves. Among free men, learning was self-discipline, not the gift of experts. From such notions, Americans derived their own academies, the French their lycées, and the Germans their gymnasium. Think of it. In Athens, instruction was unorganized, even though the city-state was surrounded by enemies and its own society engaged in the difficult social experiment of sustaining a participatory democracy, extending privileges without precedent to citizens, and maintaining literary, artistic, and legislative standards which remain to this day benchmarks of human genius. For its 500-year history from Homer to Aristotle, Athenian civilization was a miracle in a rude world. Teachers flourished there, but none was grounded in fixed buildings with regular curricula under the thumb of an intricately layered bureaucracy. There were no schools in Hellas. For the Greeks, study was its own reward. Beyond that, few cared to go. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto, The Underground History of American Education. Sparta, Athens' neighbor, was a horse of a different color. Society in Sparta was organized around the concept of cradle-to-grave formal training. The whole state was a universal schoolhouse. Official prescriptions for the population filled every waking minute, and the family was employed as a convenience for the state. Sparta's public political arrangements were an elaborate sham, organized nominally around an executive branch with two legislative bodies, but ultimate decision-making was in the hands of ephors, a small elite who conducted state policy among themselves. The practical aspect of imitation democracy figures strongly in the thought of later social thinkers such as Machiavelli and Hobbes, as well as in minds near our own time who had influence on the shape of American forced schooling. Spartan ideas of management came into American consciousness through classical studies in early schooling, through churches, and also through interest in the German military state of Prussia, which consciously modeled itself after Sparta. As the 19th century entered its final decades, American university training came to follow the Prussian-Spartan model. Service to business and the political state became the most important reason for college and university existence after 1910. No longer was college primarily about developing mind and character in the young. Instead, it was about molding those things as instruments for use by others. Here is an important clue to the philosophical split which informed the foundation of modern schooling, and to an important extent still does. small farmers, craftsfolk, tradespeople, little town and city professionals, little industrialists, and older manorial interests took a part of their dreams of America from democratic Athens or from republican Rome, not the Rome of the emperors. This comprised a significant portion of ordinary America. But new urban managerial elites pointed to a future based on Spartan outlook. When the instructional system of Athens transferred to imperial Rome, a few schools we would recognize began to appear. The familiar punishment practices of colonial America can be found anticipated vividly in the famous fresco at Herculaneum, showing a Roman schoolboy being held by two of his classmates while the master advances carrying a long whip. Roman schools must have started discipline early in the morning, for we find the poet Martial cursing a school for waking him up at cock's crow with shouts and beatings. Horace immortalizes pedagogue Orbilius for whipping a love of old poets into him. But we shouldn't be misled by these school references. What few schools there were in Rome were for boys of prosperous classes, and even most of those relied upon tutors, tradition, and emulation, not school. The word pedagogue is Latin for a specialized class of slave assigned to walk a student to the schoolmaster. Over time, the slave was given additional duties. His role was enlarged to that of drill master, a procedure memorialized in Varro's Instituit Pedagogus Docet Magister. In my rusty altar boy Latin, the master creates instructions, the slave pounds it in. A key to modern schooling is this: free men were never pedagogues. And yet, we refer to the science of modern schooling as pedagogy. The unenlightened parent who innocently brings matters of concern to the pedagogue, whether that poor soul is called schoolteacher, principal, or superintendent, is usually beginning a game of frustration which will end in no fundamental change. A case of barking up the wrong tree in a dark wood, where the right tree is far away and obscure. Pedagogy is social technology for winning attention and cooperation or obedience, while strings are attached to the mind and placed in the hands of an unseen master. This may be done holistically, with smiles, music, and light-duty simulations of intellection, or it can be done harshly, with rigorous drills and competitive tests. The quality of self-doubt aimed for, in either case, is similar. Pedagogy is a useful concept to help us unthread some of the mysteries of modern schooling. That it is increasingly vital to the social order is evinced by the quiet teacher pay revolution that has occurred since the 1960s. As with police work, to which pedagogy bears important similarities, school pay has become relatively good. Its hours of labor short, its job security first rate. Contrast this with the golden years of one-room schooling, where the pay was subsistence only and teachers were compelled to board around to keep body and soul together. Yet there was no shortage then of applicants, and many sons of prominent Americans began their adult lives as schoolteachers. With the relative opulence of today, it would be simple to fill teaching slots with accomplished men and women if that were a goal. A little adjustment in what are rationally indefensible licensing requirements would make talented people, many performance-tested adults in their 50s and 60s, available to teach. That there is not such fluid access is a good sign the purpose of schooling is more than it appears. The year-in, year-out consistency of mediocre teacher candidates demonstrates clearly that the school institution actively seeks, nurtures, hires, and promotes the caliber of personnel it needs. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto, The Underground History of American Education. When Rome dissolved in the 6th century, Roman genius emerged as the universal Christian church, an inspired religious sect grown spontaneously into a vehicle which invested ultimate responsibility for personal salvation in the sovereign individual. The Roman Church hit upon schooling as a useful adjunct. And so what few schools could be found after the fall of Rome were in ecclesiastical hands, remaining there for the next 11 or 12 centuries. Promotion inside the church began to depend on having first received training of the Hellenic type. Thus, a brotherhood of thoughtful men was created from the demise of the empire and from the necessity of intellectually defining the new mission. As the church experimented with schooling, students met originally at the teacher's house, but gradually some church space was dedicated for the purpose. Thanks to competition among church officials, each bishop strove to offer a school, and these in time to be called cathedral schools, attracted attention and some important sponsorship, each being a showcase of the bishop's own educational taste. When the Germanic tribes evacuated northern Europe, overrunning the south, cathedral schools and monastic schools trained the invading leadership, a precedent of disregarding local interests which has continued ever after. Cathedral schools were the important educational institutions of the Middle Ages. From them derived all the schools of Western Europe, at least in principle. In practice, however, few forms of later schooling would be the intense intellectual centers these were. The seven liberal arts made up the main curriculum. Lower studies were composed of grammar, rhetoric, and dialectic. Grammar was an introduction to literature, rhetoric an introduction to law and history, dialectic the path to philosophical and metaphysical disputation. Higher studies included arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. Arithmetic was well beyond simple calculation, entering into descriptive and analytical capacities of numbers and their prophetic use, which became modern statistics. Geometry embraced geography and surveying. Music covered a broad course in theory. Astronomy prepared entry into physics and advanced mathematics. Between the 11th and 14th centuries, an attempt to reduce the influence of emotionality in religion took command of church policy. Presenting the teachings of the church in scientific form became the main ecclesiastical purpose of school, a tendency called scholasticism. This shift from emotion to intellect resulted in great skill in analysis, in comparison and contrasts, in classifications and abstractions, as well as famous verbal hair-splitting, like how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. Scholasticism became the basis for future upper-class schooling. The official use of common schooling was invented by Plato. After him, the idea languished, its single torchbearer, the church. Educational offerings from the church were intended for, though not completely limited to, those young whose parentage qualified them as a potential guardian class. You would hardly know this from reading any standard histories of Western schooling intended for the clientele of teacher colleges. Intense development of the Platonic ideal of comprehensive social control through schooling suddenly appeared 2,000 years later in 18th century France at the hands of a philosophical cultus known to history as philosophes, enthusiastic promoters of the bizarre idea of mass forced schooling. Most prominent among them, a self-willed man named Jean-Jacques Rousseau. To add piquancy to Rousseau's thought, you need to know that when they were born, he chose to give away his own five offspring to strangers. If any man captures the essence of Enlightenment transformation, it is Rousseau. The Enlightenment project was conceived as a series of stages, each further leveling mankind, collectivizing ordinary humanity into a colonial organism like a Volvox. The penetration of this idea, at least on the periphery of our own founder's consciousness, is captured in the powerful mystery image of the pyramid on the obverse of our great seal. Of course, this was only one of the many colors to emerge with the new nation, and it was not the most important. an inference can be drawn from the fact that the pyramid was kept from public notice until 1935. Then it appeared suddenly on the back of our $1 bill, signaling a profound shift in political management. The ideal of a leveling Oriental pedagogy, expressed through government schooling, was promoted by the Jacobin orators of the French National Convention in the early 1790s, the commencement years of our own republic. The notion of forced schooling was irresistible to French radicals, an enthusiasm whose foundation had been laid in preceding centuries by utopian writers like Harrington, Moore, Bacon, Campanella, and other speculative fantasy embracing the fate of children. Cultivating a collective social organism was considered the ingredient missing from feudal society, an ingredient which would allow the West the harmony and stability of the East. Utopian schooling is never about learning in the traditional sense. It's about the transformation of human nature. The core of the difference between Occident and Orient lies in our power relationship between privileged and ordinary, and in respective outlooks on human nature. In the West, a metaphorical table is spread by society. The student decides how much to eat. In the East, the teacher makes that decision. The Chinese character for school shows a passive child with adult hands pouring knowledge into his empty head. To mandate outcomes centrally would be a major step in the destruction of Western identity. Management by objectives, whatever those objectives might be, is a technique of corporate subordination, not of education. Like Alfred's, Charlemagne's awareness of Asia was sharpened in mortal combat. He was the first secular Western potentate to beat the drum for secular schooling. It was easy to ignore Plato's gloomy forecast that however attractive utopia appears in imagination, human nature will not live easily with the degree of synthetic constraint it requires. By the standards of the time, America was utopia already. No grinding poverty, no dangerous national enemies, no indigenous tradition beyond a general spirit of exuberant optimism, a belief that the land had been touched by destiny, a conviction Americans could accomplish anything. John Jay wrote to Jefferson in 1787, "The enterprise of our country is inconceivable." Inconceivable, that is, to the British, Germans, and French, who were accustomed to keeping the common population on a leash. Our colonial government was the creation of the crown, of course, but soon a fantastic idea began to circulate, a belief that people might create or destroy governments at their will. The empty slate of the New Republic made it vulnerable to advanced utopian thinking. While in England and Germany, temptation was great to develop and use Oriental social machinery to bend mass population into an instrument of elite will, in America, there was no hereditary order or traditional direction. We were a nation awash in literate, self-reliant men and women, the vast majority with an independent livelihood or ambitions toward getting one. Americans were inventors and technicians without precedent, entrepreneurs unlocked from traditional controls, dreamers, confidence men, flim-flam artists. There was never a social stew quite like it. The practical difficulties these circumstances posed to utopian governing would have been insuperable except for one seemingly strange source of enthusiasm for such an endeavor in the business community. That puzzle can be solved by considering how the promise of democracy was a frightening terra incognita to the men of substance. To look to men like Sam Adams or Tom Paine as directors of the future was like looking down the barrel of a loaded gun, at least to people of means. So the men who had begun the revolution were eased out by the men who ended it. As early as 1784, a concerted effort was made by the Boston business community to overthrow town meetings, replacing them with a professionally managed corporation. Joseph Barrell, a wealthy merchant, claimed that citizen safety could be enhanced this way, and besides, a great number of very respectable gentlemen wished it. Timothy Dwight, longtime president of Yale after 1795 and a pioneer in modern education, advocating science as the center of curriculum, fought a mighty battle against advancing democracy. Democracy was hardly the sort of experiment men of affairs would willingly submit their lives and fortunes to for very long. This tension explains much about how our romance with forced schooling came about. It was a way to stop democracy aborning, as Germany had done. Much ingenuity was expended on this problem in the early Republic, particularly by so-called liberal Christian sects like Unitarians and Universalists. If you read relics of their debates, preserved from select lyceums, private meetings at which such minutes were kept, journals, recollections of drawing-room conversations and club discussions, you will see that what was shaping up was an attempt to square the circle, to give the appearance that the new society was true to its founding promise, while at the same time a sound basis could be established for the meritorious to run things. Once again, the spirit of Sparta was alive with its ephors and its reliance on forced instruction. In discussion, speeches, sermons, editorials, experimental legislation, letters, diaries, and elsewhere, the ancient idea of mass forced schooling was called forth and mused upon. And I'm reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. By the end of the first quarter of the 19th century, a form of school technology was up and running in America's larger cities, one in which children of lower-class customers were psychologically conditioned to obedience under pretext they were learning reading and counting, which may have also happened. These were the Lancaster Schools, sponsored by Governor DeWitt Clinton of New York, and prominent Quakers like Thomas Eddy, builder of the Erie Canal. They soon spread to every corner of the nation where the problem of an incipient proletariat existed. Lancaster schools are cousins of today's school factories. What few knew then or realize now is that they were also a Hindu invention, designed with the express purpose of retarding intellectual development. And I've been reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. That was Chapter 1, The Way Things Used to Be. We'll continue with the conclusion of Chapter 1 next week. You can contact us through our website, unwelcomeguest.org, where you can download MP3s and podcasts of this and previous programs. Our theme music is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.